Welcome to Friday. Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. Good to have you along today. Also with us, Monica Guzman, director of the Evergrey Newsletter. Hi, Monica.
Hi.
Eli Sanders, associate editor at The Stranger, co-host of the Blabbermouth podcast. I believe a Pulitzer Prize has happened. Eli, welcome.
Nice to be back.
Great to see you. Rob McKenna was former attorney general. Now he's in private practice. What is it? Orrick, Harrington, and Sutcliffe,
You're
right?
Good. Absolutely.
Good to see all of you. Thanks for coming. So this week, Seattle-based Starbucks once again landed in the middle of America's racial reckoning.
Well, what did they do? What did they do? Someone tell me what they did.
They didn't do anything. I saw the entire thing.
Late last week at a Philadelphia Starbucks, two black men were waiting for a meeting to happen. One of them wanted to use the bathroom and was told he'd have to buy something. The man objected and he refused an order to leave the store, and the store manager called the cops.
Hi, I have two gentlemen on my cafe that are refusing to make a purchase or leave. I'm at the Starbucks at 18th and Spruce.
The cops came, they took away the men in handcuffs, and on Monday, Starbucks CEO Kevin Johnson apologized.
I'll say the circumstances surrounding the incident and the outcome in our store on Thursday were reprehensible. They were wrong. And for that, I personally apologize to the two gentlemen that visited our store.
Starbucks says it will close its stores for an afternoon next month to give its employees racial bias training. Now, obviously, there's corporate PR here, but Monica, you think Starbucks made a bold move?
Oh, I mean, yeah, I don't know how many of us expected that they would go as far as to close all their stores for an afternoon. And I think if you read between the lines on Starbucks in the last several years, They like to be perceived as a bold company, and they like to be perceived as on the right side of social issues. And we know that Howard Schultz, you know, has a soft spot for all kinds of causes. So I think it's pretty clear that as soon as they were implicated in this, you know, things started moving in the company to say, okay, what can we do? How big can we do? And then they did something pretty big.
Eli, did it work for you? Did you perceive Starbucks as being on the right side of social justice?
I think it's a good step. I think that shutting down all of the stores in the country, if I understand it right, is a strong response. I was really struck by the experience that the men had. When you zoom back out, it's coming into a coffee shop, finding that the third person for your meeting is not there yet. You've arrived early for an important meeting, which is what everyone tells you to do if you're trying to, you know, be a successful entrepreneur, which it sounds like is what these two men were trying to be. So they arrive early, and they are told, one of them, they can't use the bathroom until they buy something. Okay, goes and sits back down. Maybe he's going to get a coffee when his third, you know, the third party of this meeting shows up. And as I heard it, 2 minutes pass between when he says, you know, I'm not going to get a coffee right now, and the police are called. How many of us have sat at Starbucks for far longer than 2 minutes and not purchased anything?
Yeah, I did that like last week, maybe twice.
You were asked to, you were told you can't use the bathroom, but you have to buy something?
Oh, no, I've never been told anything, but I have definitely spent, you know, periods of time in a Starbucks before buying something because I'm waiting for someone or what have you.
So I would suggest that beyond diversity training or racial sensitivity training, which is a great idea, there should be some clarity on what the policy is about hanging out in Starbucks, which wants to be, in all of its advertising materials, as they've reached me, a place where you hang out, right? It has this kind of association, and I think it's cultivated this, with the American ideal of the coffee shop where you sit and linger and talk and time passes and other people come in and you talk to them. That's what it wants to be. So it's got to get some clarity around these rules about who can linger and for how long.
By the way, I want to disclose here that my wife deals with all these questions professionally because she is the Starbucks director of inclusion and diversity and equity and accessibility.
Oh.
Wow. So, and you know, I'm not allowed to speak through her for the company. Obviously, mm-hmm. that's how it works. But that's my understanding of all this.
And yeah.
But to say the obvious, yes, the questions about what should the policy be. For a chain, they've got all these different stores. There's a code on some doors. There's no code on another. There's single stalls in others. They're all different. And what are we saying we want from them? Should a purchase not be required to use their bathroom?
Yeah, I don't know.
It's pretty common for stores to say that a purchase is required. You see it all the time, particularly in areas that are really touristy. where they're trying to steer people towards the public bathrooms. And it's reasonable for a property owner to want to limit bathroom use to its customers because there is a cost to maintaining the restroom. You want the restroom to be available. Then it comes down to, well, is there really a problem or not? Are you really trying to solve a problem or not? It's interesting that this store had these particular guidelines where unpaying customers were asked or supposed to be asked to leave. I guess that's to free up seats. They don't want people loitering. But if it's true, these guys were only there for a very short time when this happened. That raises a lot of troubling questions about why they were singled out after that short period of time, particularly since one of them says that he'd been going to that Starbucks since he was 15 years old. He's now 23.
Right.
Monica, you were saying that you were struck by how this brings race into a setting that is so relatable to so many different kinds of people and such a big number of people across the country.
Right, right. I think that's one reason this got so big so fast is that we've all been there. We've all been there in the coffee shop. And how many of us would expect to be treated that way, that quickly? Because it was 2 minutes between when they walked in and they got that call.
I think a lot of us have also, I'll speak for myself here, but I think it's probably a common experience. A lot of us have also been in coffee shops in Seattle, Starbucks even, where people are coming in because they need to use the bathroom because they're homeless. And it is a challenging situation in a city that does not provide, speaking about Seattle only, I don't know about this part of Pennsylvania where this happened, but that doesn't provide public restrooms and enough facilities for homeless people. So in that way, Starbucks and other businesses are feeling the effects of a city that has not sufficiently tackled its homelessness problem. That's not the situation that was going on in Pennsylvania, but I think we all have also likely experienced this situation in Starbucks where we watch people who are employed by Starbucks tangle with the issue of who gets to use the bathroom and who doesn't. It's another job of being a Starbucks barista. You're like the bathroom police.
Yeah, and not only, the bathroom police, and also it's the baristas and store managers who are cleaning up.
Right.
You can imagine needles, blood, bodily issue. I mean, these are not, it's not like there's an outside firm that at least, I don't know about every single Starbucks, but it's just
the baristas
are dealing
with a
lot.
Do it all.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I remember Seattle was fairly early on the Wi-Fi at coffee shops train. There's a fun New York Times article from way back when about this trend of Wi-Fi in coffee shops. And back in the days of blogging in the late 2000s, there were a lot of blog posts about the etiquette when you go and you work at a coffee shop or you linger there a long time and, people arguing back and forth, you should buy something for every 2 hours or 3 hours. Mm-hmm. But I think it has been sort of clear that the etiquette is if you're going to hang out in a coffee shop, buy something.
Right.
But how far exactly, do we want companies to take that policy?
I was in Hong Kong and I was at a Starbucks. I think it was a Starbucks. And in order to get access to the Wi-Fi, you had to have a code. And the way you got the code was by purchasing something.
Mm-hmm.
And then the code was good for a fixed period of time. Then it expired. And then you had no more Wi-Fi until you bought the next item.
Right.
That was pretty clever and it seemed to be effective. It was a very busy store. It was in a mall, as I recall. So it seemed like an effective way to give people the benefit of the Wi-Fi, but also to have some control over it.
Wow. And see, technology is letting us do things like that. A coworker of mine was jokingly talking about, why not just a code on the outside of Starbucks? And you got to use your mobile app to have bought something before you come in. I mean, there's all kinds of possibilities for shutting people out or requiring purchase.
Oh, man. But yeah, imagine who that rules out.
And for algorithms tracking who uses the bathroom a lot or a little.
Oh, I suppose so. And how long they nurse their cup of coffee while they're writing their screenplay. Mm-hmm. And then finally, we have the factor of a person pulling out her cell phone to document all of this. I once interviewed a couple of black colleagues in Seattle who were at they were professors at two different places and are educators, and they had someone spit on them, racial epithets, the whole thing, and I think one person at the store acknowledged it, and so there's that too. It's the bystanders. What do the rest of us do when we're seeing racism in action?
Yeah, and I wonder if y'all would agree that it feels like one of the things that's changing in society right now is a sense that we are all sort of implicated in these incidents happening around us, and that there's more of an obligation to share them or do something about them, even if they're not happening to you. And that's because really, I don't know, had her name was Melissa, had Melissa not taken out her phone and taken this video, I'm not sure we'd be having this conversation.
Yeah, that's
that
a
got
really
11 million views.
11 million views. That's really astounding. Yeah. And I feel kind of bad for folks at Starbucks who are generally concerned about race issues. Of course, Howard Schultz famously tried to have a conversation about race.
Yes.
It did not work out
terribly
well. But it was well-intentioned, I think, and I've heard him speak about it. It is sad and ironic that this controversy visited Starbucks, but given that they've tried to do the right thing, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But you've got 8,000 stores and a lot of humans who are fallible, making decisions. Things are going to happen. I like the way they're responding to it now.
Yeah, and I mean, they're trying to be America's living room, so fights are going to break out. You know, we're going to have some scuffles in our public
living room. I've never been to your living room.
Get your feet off the coffee table.
Exactly.
Well, that's the Starbucks story of the week, and in May, the day after Memorial Day, I believe, 8,000 stores. I think those are standalone stores, maybe. I don't think that counts the ones tucked into airports or grocery stores.
They're not owned by Starbucks.
Right.
They're like franchises.
But thousands of Starbucks stores will close down for an afternoon for racial bias training. You're listening to The Week in Review with Eli Sanders, Rob McKenna, Monica Guzman. I'm Bill Radke, and we're going to be right back. We're live tweeting The Week in Review at KUOW. It's so much easier to spell than it is for me to say. I'm Bill Radke. Eli Sanders is here, Rob McKenna, Monica Guzman, and we're recapping the week's news. And this week, the fired FBI director, James Comey, called President Trump morally unfit to be president.
A person who sees moral equivalence in Charlottesville, who talks about and treats women like they're pieces of meat, who lies constantly about matters big and small, that person's not fit to be president of the United States.
Comey did interviews to promote his new book called A Higher Loyalty, Truth, Lies, and Leadership. James Comey is getting criticized for this book from the right and the left. He's being criticized for trading insults with Trump, for inserting himself into the story. Rob, you are a law and order professional, as Comey is. You were Washington State Attorney General. What's your professional take on Comey's role as the FBI director, his book tour?
Well, I had no real concerns with his role as FBI director, notwithstanding the questions about his announcement in October of 2016. You can debate that, but I think
talking
in general,
about the Hillary Clinton investigation.
Yeah, when there were more emails that were found that happened to be on Anthony Weiner's laptop because his wife was using it, who worked for Hillary Clinton. But Comey was well regarded as a law enforcement professional, and I understood why he made that decision in October, and I think you can argue it both ways. But since then, I'm concerned, particularly about the book and his extraordinary publicity tour. I think he would have been better off. The country would be better off if he had waited until after the Mueller investigation was completed release the book. Well, he could be a witness in this investigation, and now he looks like a publicity hound. And
is that a legal problem or a public perception problem?
Yeah, I think it hurts his credibility as a witness because he doesn't look as professional. Now we're thinking of him as James Comey, the book author, not so much as the FBI director. I think he hurt his credibility in the sense that it looks like he's seeking publicity. As one newspaper said, he's inserting himself into the fray. And it just isn't helpful to the investigation. My second concern about his decision to release this book now is that I worry about the effect on the FBI itself as an institution. The Trump and his allies are just pounding on the FBI, and its credibility with the public is going down. Morale is low. I've had a lot of friends there over the years, and have a lot of respect for them as an institution. And I think that they're being harmed, have been harmed, and Comey is harming them further here.
Eli Sanders, not helpful as a witness, not helpful to the FBI's credibility. Do you care?
I have concerns about whether he's credible as a witness because I want him to be a credible witness if he needs to be in the Mueller investigation or in any grand jury action or trial, I guess, in the future. So, yes, I would like James Comey to remain as credible as possible. And I actually agree with most of what Rob was saying in terms of potential downsides for what he's doing. On the other hand, I am enjoying having a new voice in the fray who is somewhat above politics, or at least more than, you know, the more than Chuck Schumer or Nancy Pelosi or any of the leaders of the Democratic Party.
Was Comey a Republican? He is. He was.
Yes, right.
He was a Republican, but this week, as part of his book tour, he announced that he's left the party, or actually the party left him. But it's—
Is that ringing any bells for you, Rob McKenna?
I know people say the party left me. It actually doesn't work that way. But I understand what he's saying, and I think if he hadn't been fired, he wouldn't be saying that. Which is not to say I think he should have been fired, but you know,
you're
clearly,
still a Republican, right, Rob?
Absolutely. If you don't like what your party's doing, get in there and try to fix it. That's the solution. We're a two-party country. We're always going to be a two-party country, in my opinion. And so, if you don't like it, get more active. It's the activists that make the difference in your party.
Monica.
Yeah, I, you know, this conversation about Comey getting into the fray, in some weird ways, I see him as getting out of something. I sort of wonder, you know, Comey's motivation in doing things this way, going after Trump in this way, considering the care he seems to have for the institutions of the government. And I mean, he's expressed that many times. So one thing I wonder is sort of, is this, you know, an acknowledgement that Trump has never been in the ring, in that Trump was never a conventional politician. He was never going to play by the rules. That's why a lot of people voted for him. And is this Comey saying, fine, I'll step out of the ring, too. I'll stop playing by the rules. I'll write this book. It'll be strangely timed. And we're just going to make this personal.
Yeah, Rob, I think Comey's argument is, yeah, I'm breaking some norms because we have a much bigger norm breaker in the presidency and the country is in danger. And he has, as his book title says, a higher loyalty.
But his feud with Trump, which is obviously very personal, given the personal comments that he included in his book about Trump's hands and his orange skin and all of that, you know, that should not be his desire.
Fair to color his whole case against Trump,
so to speak,
on a couple of acknowledgments of those public memes?
Yeah, of course it is, because he included it. It's being covered. People are talking about it. You don't include stuff like that unless you expect it to be commented on. I mean, he's responsible for it. So my point is this: if he has a higher duty, it's a higher duty to the institution he led, the FBI, and it's a higher duty to the rule of law, which means don't do anything that could be in any way compromising to an investigation which is underway. After all, he dedicated his career to law enforcement.
This is the dilemma of Donald Trump. If you try to get into it with him, you have to just, by definition, get down on his level, because he never comes above his level. And so to have any sort of dialogue with him, you have to talk to him on the level that he exists on. And then, yeah, it ends up demeaning you. But if there is an urgency, which I think there is, and obviously James Comey thinks there is, then there is a value to getting into it with him, to provoking him in a way that causes him to show what he actually is and remind people again and again how he degrades the discourse and our democracy and so on. It's the problem of, you know, what happens when you wrestle with a pig, which we can't give the second part of that on public radio, but look it up. If you don't know it, that's what James Comey is experiencing right now.
I guess we can't tweet out to our listeners what happens with a pig either if it's not appropriate.
There's a clean version. The pig, no, you get dirty and the pig likes it.
Yeah. Hey, there you go.
That's what happens.
You're welcome. This is KOW's Week in Review with Monica Guzman and Eli Sanders and Rob McKenna. I'm Bill Radke. The Trump presidency has us reflecting on presidencies of the past, comparing and contrasting, and the wife of, the mother of a former Republican president died this week, and we'll talk about the local and national reaction to that in just a moment. KUOW's Week in Review continuing now. As I said, the former First Lady, Barbara Bush, died on Tuesday, and this week, Seattle City Council member Kshama Sawant was one of many people to criticize the progressive group Women's March for the way the group chose to memorialize Barbara Bush. The group, Women's March, tweeted, quote, "Rest in peace and power, Barbara Bush," with a photo of her. And Sawant tweeted back, "This is terrible. Women's March organizers have helped lead historic protests since Trump's election, but this tweet shows how, without a political compass, even well-meaning progressives can end up giving cover to ruling class and ultimately undermining struggles against oppression." First of all, Eli Sanders, what do you think Women's March meant by rest in peace and power?
Well, in my encountering of this phrase, rest in power, it's usually used on the left and really in more progressive quarters of the left to memorialize someone who's fought a big, bold, progressive fight and passed on. So that is my understanding of where the phrase gets used and where it comes from. What the Women's March was going for in tweeting this out with respect to Barbara Bush, I don't know. I don't know whether it was a kind of conscious attempt to, in a way that was going to really upset some people, co-opt a phrase, or whether they really were trying to say, look, you may have disagreed with her politics, but she was a powerful woman who played a powerful role in society, and that is, bottom line, what some of the Women's March is about, more women being able to attain more powerful positions.
That's interesting. I took it as, Barbara Bush, you didn't get to have power in your life because you were born a woman in 1925. You deserved the chance to be powerful.
Well.
So everyone's seeing this a different way. What about
yeah.
you, Monica?
I mean, I assumed the latter part of what Eli said, which was that they just meant to acknowledge that this was a powerful and influential woman, and that at least on that side, all women are sort of united as women.
But what power did she have as the husband of the wife of the president?
I actually didn't realize that rest in peace and power was already a phrase used by progressives, so I didn't have that context either.
Rest in power is what I hear.
Rest in
and
power.
So if the Women's March said rest in peace and power, maybe they're trying to merge like the religious kind of phrase and the more radical phrase. I don't know.
Maybe
what
they were just trying to be nice. It's like, you know.
Well, but when
like,
you choose the word, especially the power part, I mean, they're trying to say something, right?
Sure. They were using a phrase which I assume they're familiar with and applying it. To me, it's a little bit like, you know, going to another culture and then draping a local garment over your shoulders as a sign of respect. This is ours. We're going to give a little bit of it to you for a minute. So it's a way to express oneself, which is a sign of respect. And that's a kind of decency which we need in this society, certainly when we need to bridge the divide. And, you know, Mrs. Bush did have power in the sense that she was an advisor to her husband. They were very close. She didn't have the power that he had as the elected president.
But those are so two completely different definitions of power. Doesn't that just highlight how, I mean, think of what that means, that we think of that as a relatively powerful role, to be married to a powerful person.
The fact,
kind of the backdrop to what we're talking about?
Well, I mean, the first spouse has a certain amount of influence. They are not powerless, even if they don't have the power of the president.
What influence?
Well, maybe just to insert the kind of at least myth around Bush, Barbara Bush, is that she herself was such a strong figure that she created these powerful men, and that's never been like hidden. You know,
what does that mean? She created them.
She was a really tough mother, and
I don't know what that means. I'm not saying it's wrong. I just don't. I've heard all these words this week.
Not only
and she
that,
was so tough, and I just don't know what.
I mean, I don't want to sit here and defend her, but I've read enough that I know.
And I'm not
the
attacking
narrative.
Her.
And the narrative is that she was very tough, very decent. Very exacting, expected a lot of her kids and her husband, and was a
like a parent.
Sure,
she was known to live by the golden rule. There's a pretty well known story about her where a female Secret Service agent showed up at her room in a hotel and asked if she could borrow the clothes iron from Mrs. Bush's room, and Mrs. Bush insisted that she just hand over the blouse and she ironed it for her. which is a story that got repeated a lot because it shows a kind of decency and a kind of everyday person
attitude. Oh, absolutely.
Attitude.
She seemed decent.
She was well. I mean, everyone who does histories of the White House say the staff really liked Mr. and Mrs. Bush
okay.
because they were kind, decent people.
Yes.
And we need that, you know, and we've seen what it's like not to have that. We've been reminded of it lately.
So Monica, what did you make of Councilmember Sawant's critique of the Women's March, that this is them not having a political compass, and I'm looking for her words, saying being well-meaning progressives giving cover to the ruling class and ultimately undermining struggles against oppression.
Yeah, there's a lot there.
Yes.
I mean, I think to Rob's point, it's difficult these days to pass a compliment from one side of a culture war to another.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's ultimately what this shows. Also, there are very, you know, strong, empowered sort of factions today on all sides of the political spectrum. And what this felt like to me was sort of an assertion, you know, to those who sort of believe in politics the way Councilmember Sawant does, that let's not forget that this is a ground we need to hold, and we cannot be complimenting Barbara Bush this way. This is not something we can be doing.
For people who feel like the phrase rest in power is for and by radical progressive activists, another reason why they might be upset about it being draped around Barbara Bush is what she said, for example, after Hurricane Katrina about the Superdome in Texas. This has come back up this week also. So this is another part of her character, and this is the record.
She said that the people who were forced to evacuate were underprivileged anyway,
and
right?
So
this had worked out well for them.
Exactly. This is working out very well for them. And so that had a tone deafness and beyond to it. And a lot of people were upset, and they felt like it revealed something about her character, something essential about her character. And they connected it to the policies of her husband and her sons. And so, you know, there are a lot of people who don't feel like she is anything close to, and maybe actually exactly the opposite of, a radical activist.
Does this also get to a divide that we have? We keep talking about the political tension where maybe the people in the Women's March are reaching out to Republican women, and maybe some people see what they notice is the how can you reach out to the bad people?
Well, you know, let me bring another example into the conversation. You know, Mr. and Mrs. Obama, President and Mrs. Obama are going to attend the private funeral service for Mrs. Bush this week. It is well known that the Obamas and the Bushes get along well, that they have become friends at a level, and they think it's important to talk to each other, notwithstanding their political and ideological differences.
That's what I'm getting at.
I think the Obamas are modeling something important for us. They're modeling decency and compassion and a willing to keep talking. And we need more of that. I think Sawant's approach is don't talk, no compromise, stay at the barricades. And unless we want to go from a culture war to an actual war, we need this kind of dialogue. We have to find the middle ground, the common ground. And, you know, kudos to at Women's March organizers for, you know, putting this little statement out there, this little gesture of decency. Mm.
That is the discussion, the controversy this week around how to memorialize Barbara Bush, who died this week, and how to go forward together, whether we agree or not. We're talking here on The Week in Review about what happened this week and why it matters, and we're going to bring in the Seagals to the discussion and the Supreme Court case that finds our current Attorney General in an unusual position, and a sign on I-5 this week that maybe it told you something you ought to hear. I don't know. Stay tuned.
I didn't realize it about myself until I read the sign.
That's the former State Attorney General, Rob McKenna, Eli Sanders, Associate Editor at The Stranger, Monica Guzman, co-founder of the Evergrey Newsletter. I'm Bill Radke. Continuing the Week in Review, and by the way, we're live tweeting at KUOW. This week, the New York Times reported on an equal employment complaint filed by a former NFL cheerleader. Bailey Davis was part of the New Orleans Saints cheer squad called the Saintsations. It's like sensations. I heard this interview with her I thought she was saying Saint Stations, and I thought it was the Catholic Stations of the Cross, the Saint Stations.
It's an awkward name.
I was very wrong. So anyway, Bailey Davis says that she was fired over an Instagram post on her personal account. She's posing in a bodysuit or some kind of lingerie.
After I posted it, I was immediately called into HR, and they fired me as soon as I sat down. They said it was distasteful, it violated our code of conduct, and I had a dirty face, which made it seductive, and I was inviting players to contact me.
She had a dirty face.
Whoa.
Inviting players. Her attorney, Sarah Blackwell, claims that the team discriminated against Bailey Davis on the basis of her gender because the team rules put much more of a burden on the female cheerleaders than the rules put on the male players.
NFL players are allowed to contact them. They have no prohibitions in contacting the cheerleaders, texting them, messaging them, being in the same location as them. Whereas the cheerleaders, if they are contacted by a player, they have to immediately block them and they can't respond. So in that sense, it's discriminatory based on gender.
Monica, we were talking earlier about the strange job that is cheerleader. You're not anti-cheerleader.
No. No.
But it's a strange cultural moment we're in when it comes to that profession.
It's more about that. The way I was thinking about it was, you know, the Me Too movement started very quickly, started very much on sexual abuse and sexual harassment, but it has made lots of people look at the entire world very differently. And so my question is, you know, just how far does that movement and its ideas really spread? Because it spread to Hollywood, it spread to movies, it spread to the ways we, you know, show women in media, and does it spread to all the ways in which we put women in a display case? You know, both because they are sort of trapped and constrained, and also because they're so pretty to look at, and that's how our society usually treats them. And when you consider,
and there are thousands of women who want that job, you know, in a squad of whatever it does,
right? And they take very little pay, and they take, you know, a lot of limitations on their behavior, but they do take it. They have for a while. This is complicated, but I don't see going forward. It's hard for me to imagine that NFL cheerleading is going to remain the same for much longer.
Former Attorney General, do you have any take on the EEOC, the equal employment claims here about discrimination on gender?
Yeah, they may have a basis for a claim here, actually. It'll be interesting to see how it plays out. The teams are obviously entitled to put rules into place for all of their personnel. And I understand why it's easy to compare the cheerleaders to the players and the rules that apply, but there are lots and lots of people in a professional football organization who are not players. So it might be more appropriate to put the cheerleaders in the category with the other non-player personnel to see how that stacks up and whether they're being treated equally compared to those other people or not.
Well, you I presume, read this account or heard this account of the cheerleaders are instructed to, at least in, this is the New Orleans case, I don't know if this applies to every team with cheerleaders, but for example, if you're in a restaurant cheerleader and a player walks in, you have to leave the restaurant. You have to actively block players from your social media feeds. That's your problem, cheerleader. The players don't get penalized for trying to follow a cheerleader.
Right. That seems to me
to
be dumb and unfair. So
and then
it should be a two-way street.
They have to pay for their own makeup and uniforms and, you know.
Well, that part is a little easier to understand because there is a lot of competition to be on the cheerleading squad just as there is to be a player. But people are there to see the players. The cheerleading squads are, an extra. They add to the ambiance. I think they do, at least for some fans, add value.
So
they
that's
do
a not lot a legal of, problem.
No, it's not. But it's really an economic issue. I mean, how important is it to – my question is how important is having cheerleaders to the fans? It's significant to me that six teams, including some of the most storied franchises in the NFL, Chicago, Green Bay, and so forth, choose not to have them. And apparently there's no big outcry over it. Here in the Seattle market, you know, I've seen the Seagulls at public events where they come and it's part of their community service. And I respect that. I think that they feel like they're giving back to the community.
Do you see them in bikinis having to sell you calendars? And if they don't sell enough, they have to pay for them themselves, which was also part of this?
For the Seagulls or for another team?
This was in New Orleans.
Oh, New Orleans.
We found out a bit about the Seagulls. we found a contract from 2015 was the latest we could find. But the cheerleaders, the rules strongly discourage, quote, strongly discourage fraternization between Seagulls and Seahawks players, coaches, mascot, and management personnel. The rules don't define fraternization, but they say that fraternizing, dating, cohabiting, or marrying current Seahawks employees may result in removal from the squad.
Can we just pause on that, the mascot part? They can't fraternize with the mascot. I mean,
with the bird.
Yeah, Blitz. I just had a comment on that. I mean, really?
In terms of equal opportunity, let's just talk about it in a broader sense. I would like to know why there aren't more male cheerleaders.
Yeah, the LA Rams have introduced, I believe it's two male cheerleaders to their squad. Then some of them have I think a few men doing different kinds of stunts,
sure.
But it's not the same. It's not the pom-poms.
You go to the UW football games, or most college games that I've been to, they have male cheerleaders as well as female. And they're very athletic. All of them are. And they're doing all kinds of gymnastic stunts and so forth. It's pretty cool, actually. And frankly, it seems a little less troubling for the reason Monica was talking about than what we see at NFL games.
I think it sort of goes to show that, you know, the NFL, Wall Street Journal, I think, wrote a story years ago about how a whole football game on TV is actually 11 minutes of actual football. It's a media event, right? And those cheerleaders have rules about weight gain, you're off, you know, the way you have to have your skin and the way you have
to players have to monitor their weight gain as well.
Right. So it's, you know, to the point that cheerleading is an athletic event. It is and it can be, but it isn't so much athletic as something else in the NFL. And I think that's kind of clear.
You think the Seagulls are going to look very different in, I don't know, a year, 5 years? Do you think this is going to change?
When they have an all-male Seagulls cast, let me know. I'll go to more football games.
Sea dudes.
Sea people. Yeah, or just no cheerleader at all in Seattle, as it is in with the Packers.
You know, you guarantee if the Seahawks decided to eliminate the Seagulls as opposed to having men come in as the UW Huskies do, there'd be a big outcry by some vocal minority of the fan base. So they probably won't do it because for that reason they'll cite the community service aspect that these women are involved in. There is demand to be a Seagull. I think there's a certain amount of prestige that comes with it.
Yeah, there's
no
a lot
question.
Of pride.
There's pride. It's cool to be associated with a popular team and to get to go to the games and all of that. So I doubt they're going to go away, and I doubt that it's going to change very much in the next 5 years.
All right. Well, the Seagulls, by the way, open tryouts this weekend at the training center, the VMAC in Renton. So now you know. You can go, I don't know, can you be a man and try out for the Seagulls?
Eli, go try out.
Yeah, I'll go find out.
Go find out, Eli.
Minimum wage. They just make minimum wage.
Yeah,
but it's Seattle minimum wage, Eli. Come on.
It is Seattle minimum wage.
That is true. That's
but
a better
Seattle
wage.
Seattle cost of living, so.
I read that they make the state minimum wage.
Yes, because their company is officially headquartered in Renton.
Oh, that's a good point.
That's right.
Loophole.
It's not 15. Loophole. It's like $11.50 or something.
Yeah, that's true.
This is the Week in Review with Monica Guzman and Eli Sanders and Rob McKenna, and we're going to come right back and talk about the Washington State at the Supreme Court again this week and fake President Obama and more. Continuing with the Week in Review, now I'm Bill Radke with Monica Guzman, Eli Sanders, and Rob McKenna. This week, Washington State went before the U.S. Supreme Court. Our state's Attorney General, Bob Ferguson, is opposing the Trump administration again, but this time he's also opposing Washington State Native tribes. He's in conflict with liberals like Governor Jay Inslee. The question is, what does it mean that you have a right to fish? Does that mean you have a right to put a net in the water? Does it mean you have the right for there to be plenty of fish for you to catch? Rob McKenna, why does it matter who wins the case of the culverts?
Well, because it's not really about culverts. Right. This case dates back to the original Bolt decision, which upheld the tribe's treaty rights to a share of the fish, which the court decided meant half the fish, which is a reasonable interpretation of treaties that date back to 1855. Not long after that initial decision was handed down, the tribes started looking for a way to establish a second principle under the treaties, which is not only they have a right to half the fish, but that they have a right to some sort of guaranteed supply of fish. That's important not so much because fish are as critical to their livelihoods as they were in 1855. They clearly aren't, even though they continue to be very important. It's because at least those of us who worked on this case, and this case dates back, it spans five attorneys general, including my 8 years as AG. It's really
what was your take on it?
My take was that it was that the tribes are trying to become co-sovereigns with state and local government over any issue that could affect the number of fish available for them to catch. I think the tribes are right that their leaders never would have signed the treaty if they thought it meant that the state could destroy all the fish and there'd be nothing left for them to catch. Clearly, it was not what they were signing up for. I also think it's true, though, that the United States government and Governor Stevens would not have signed the treaty if they thought it meant that the tribes would be co-sovereigns and could have a say in any land use decision, any kind of action that could affect the number of fish. In other words, they didn't see it as a guarantee supply of fish, of a certain number of fish to be able to catch either. Fortunately, we have lots of environmental laws and rules and regulations which are very important that are there to protect the fish, even though there aren't as many as there used to be, clearly. And the last point I'll make about this, which is an important fact to understand, is that the culverts, and this is one of the reasons I don't think the culverts are really the issue here. The culverts.
You may need to tell people what a culvert is.
Oh,
this
I'm
is
sorry.
How fish get through underneath a road.
Big pipe under
a big
the road.
Pipe.
You've seen them. They're concrete. They're steel. There are many that are barriers to fish moving upstream. No question about it. And that's why on our parklands and on state-owned lands that Department of Natural Resources manages, they have replaced all or nearly all of the culverts which block fish. The State Department of Transportation is farther behind, mostly because of numbers, both the numbers of culverts and the cost of replacing them. But we repeatedly offered to settle this case when I was AG, based on a fixed schedule of replacing all the culverts under state highways, and our efforts to settle on that basis were rejected. I think, now keep in mind, I was an advocate for the state, so I have a point of view here. I'm not pretending to be, argue both sides of this time. I think that they didn't want to settle with us because they want to establish this legal principle. They want what's called an environmental servitude to run with the land, which means to be able to have a say on any decision that could affect or does affect the number of fish in the water. That's a big power.
Okay, that was a lot of information. Thank
you. Yeah.
Any reaction to that from my other two panelists?
Well, it's a bit head-spinning to take in all that information, and even more head-spinning to see Bob Ferguson, who we think of as this champion of liberal values against the overweening reach of the Trump administration, going to argue in front of the Supreme Court against the tribes of this state. And outside of the legal intricacies, which I know are important and the legal principles are worth examining closely, the general idea that the state should be forced to be a good steward of the environment so that the tribes and everyone else can benefit from strong salmon runs, I actually think that most Washingtonians would agree with that idea.
Who's going to win at U.S. Supreme Court? We were just talking about football. I'm in a very bottom line mindset. Who's going to have more points in the Supreme Court?
What is the point spread there?
Yeah, right.
It's hard to say based on what happened in oral arguments where the Solicitor General very capably argued the state's point aside. It's hard to say. What could happen is this case could be remanded back to the trial court because the tribes came into the Supreme Court level of argument with what we look at is a new argument. They're basically now saying the standard is not having enough fish to make a moderate living, which has always been the standard, and instead the standard is a substantial degradation of the fish supply. That's new. And so the justices were peppering both sides with questions about what does it mean to be substantially degraded? How many fish are the right number of fish, et cetera. So the Supreme Court could kick this back to the trial court for more fact-finding and assessment on that basis, which might actually be the best outcome. The state has never argued that they don't have a duty to protect the fish, and we've spent billions of dollars to do just that. The state is arguing that the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruling is based on a principle which is very broad and will quickly be expanded beyond culverts to many, many other kinds of decisions. And
okay.
That's the concern.
Okay, so that's the case in front of the U.S. Supreme Court this week over what Washington State's rights and responsibilities are when it comes to protecting the salmon that many Washington State tribes signed on to protecting back in the 1850s, when, by the way, they gave up a lot of land. I mean,
yeah.
It wasn't exactly a freely entered into agreement, was it?
No one thought, and no one thought there wouldn't be enough fish. I mean, there were so many salmon. It was like there were so many trees, most people who were logging worried that they wouldn't be able to cut them all. I mean, it was literally outside of their scope of comprehension then.
All right, we'll see what happens. I know when the Seahawks had their Super Bowl loss remanded to the lower trial court, it didn't work. The Patriots remained the Super Bowl champs. Okay, coming up on the Week in Review, I think you might be troubled. You might laugh and be troubled simultaneously by the fake Obama that you're about to hear. Stay tuned. The Week in Review continues. I'm Bill Radke. Here is what we know to be true, right? You can't believe everything you hear. What people say, that's hearsay. You have to judge for yourself. Seeing is believing. But what if what you see is so easily and reliably faked in our near future that you can't know what's real? This is where technology may be taking us. I'm going to play for you the sound from a video. Imagine you're looking at former President Obama. He's sitting in a wooden chair in his suit, the American flag in the background, and it looks like he is saying these words.
We're entering an era in which our enemies can make it look like anyone is saying anything at any point in time, even if they would never say those things. So, for instance, they could have me say things like, Killmonger was right. Or Ben Carson is in the sunken place. Or, how about this, simply, President Trump is a total and complete Now, you see, I would never say these things, at least not in a public address, but someone else would. Someone like Jordan Peele.
And here the screen splits, and next to the visual of Obama, you see the writer-actor Jordan Peele, who is known for his Barack Obama impression. Both of their mouths are moving in sync, and you see that it's Jordan Peele talking, and the Obama video is a fake. And the point is that this is the future of fake news.
This is a dangerous time. Moving forward, we need to be more vigilant with what we trust from the internet. That's a time when we need to rely on trusted news sources. May sound basic, but how we move forward in the age of information is going to be the difference between whether we survive or whether we become some kind of f***ed up dystopia.
Well on our way.
Funny and disturbing. How did you react to this video?
I had a lot of reactions. My reaction, experiencing it just orally this time, was, oh man, if that tape ever comes out of Donald Trump in Russia, he's just going to say, oh, this is faked.
Mm-hmm.
This is what I'm talking about. Truth means nothing.
Mm-hmm.
At some point. But we're made up not there yet. I could see the video, the lips, it wasn't perfect. The impression is good. It doesn't sound exactly, but we're going to get better and better at this.
There's other technology that will actually use the voice of the real person, and they can actually replicate it.
In fact, the University of Washington computer scientists came out and showed that they can take someone's real voice and, as you say, and manipulate it to say things that the person didn't say.
Yeah, I've also been thinking anyone who makes money off of their voice, radio broadcasters, podcasters, we should all put a little more money in the bank account, because essentially what you could do is type a script, and once you've gotten, you know, enough of a sample of someone's voice, you could just use that sample to make 150 episodes of the podcast. You don't need the human there.
But they probably have to license it from you. I mean, I think you'd have a legal claim to your voice if they were using your voice because it was particularly well known.
What if they just crafted a generic soothing radio voice?
Oh, you're screwed.
Yeah. It's no good. My main reaction to this was more about, you know, the diagnosis and the prescription. The diagnosis, I think Jordan kind of got it. You know, if we don't move, we got to figure out a good way to move forward in the age of information, or we're going to be a bleep society. I think that there's some truth to that. But the key phrase that he says in that video is, we need to rely on trusted news sources. There's a big problem with that, which is that not everyone agrees what the trusted news sources are. And I think we're getting farther from having a consensus on that as a society all together now than we are getting closer. So I worry more about that. Technology can do a lot. Text can do a lot. You can manipulate with messages all day long. You've always been able to do it. Now there's more technologically sophisticated ways to do it. But at the end of the day, it's who you trust. And a lot of Americans disagree about who to trust.
And in addition to that, I think this is implicit in what you're saying, Monica, but in addition to that, a lot of people don't get their news from news sources. They get their information from Facebook. From, you know, it's a stream of information that can be from all kinds of sources that catches their eye because of the images, because of the text, because it came from someone who sent it to them. That's a huge part of the problem as well. And of course, we know that's powerful because marketers use it all the time now. Why are there so many Instagram models? Because someone you admire might be able to persuade you to buy a product.
Yep.
In terms of what do you do about this or just about fake news in general, I side with the people who say the answer is one, better civics education and media literacy education and encouragement of people to develop their critical thinking skills. That will help you across, you know, visual manipulation, written manipulation, verbal manipulation. And we may have, you know, skipped too quickly over what this video actually is into what it means and all that to help people understand this new technology. A lot of people don't know. So what this video is trying to teach you, this video that BuzzFeed put out, is that there is now technology that you can get basically off the shelf that will literally put words in someone's mouth.
Yeah, this was Adobe something, Adobe After Effects off the shelf and an artificial intelligence app.
So another thing to have in your skeptical mind when you see a video, particularly on YouTube, I would say, or online, of someone saying something.
Finally, we are just about to the end of the week in review. I just want to note, if you were driving on I-5 this week, reading the State Department of Transportation signs, you learned an uncomfortable truth about yourself. Okay, this is something that, sure, your friends might not be willing to tell you, but the DOT cares enough about you to say the things you need to hear. A motorist posted a photo out his windshield of the digital signboard displaying the message, "You suck." The Transportation Department apologized and in a statement to KCPQ-TV said that the inappropriate message was due to a training error.
I love this so much. A training error.
What was that training? Isn't that what happened in Hawaii with the fake missile
alert?
That's
the first thing I thought of.
Yeah, exactly. Just a whole lot of vague explanation.
You suck. This is not a drill. Seek immediate shelter.
Hey, truth hurts sometimes.
Who hasn't sat in traffic on the freeway and wanted to put a message on one of those reader boards that would have been worse than that?
You could fill a lot of potholes with that money.
Rob, you're an attorney. Could I, as a motorist, sue the state for emotional distress? And would I have to prove that I don't suck?
Sure. Why would you be any different?
Thanks for tuning in. Rob McKenna, a former attorney general of Washington State, and Eli Sanders is with the Stranger, associate editor there, co-host of the Blabbermouth podcast. Monica Guzman, director of the Evergrey newsletter. Live like you live here. Monica, great to see you.
Woo-hoo.
Rob, Eli, thanks a lot.
Good to be here.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for tuning in to The Week in Review.